Vaccination rates are slowing and healthcare workers have a message this week. Go get your shot. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, why FEMA workers here on the First Coast are racing to get as many shots into arms as they can this month. Give us a call and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, local immigration expert John Caulfield on what's really going on at the southern border right now. That's later. First, though, the latest numbers on the pandemic here in Florida. About 8.5 million Florida residents have been vaccinated so far. That is not nearly enough to reach herd immunity in the state. This as cases of COVID, hospitalizations, and deaths continue to climb every day. We report those numbers daily. The death toll in Florida from coronavirus now stands at 35,399. At the same time, a new survey shows that the American public's willingness to get a COVID vaccine could be reaching a saturation point. The Kaiser Family Foundation's Vaccine Monitor published a new poll that they took last month showing that only 9% of Americans said they hadn't yet gotten the shot but intended to do so. That means achieving widespread immunity in the U.S. from the virus is going to be a big challenge. That said, there are some people at the FEMA site at Gateway Mall who have a message for everyone. They're here through the end of the month, and they want you to come get vaccinated. Kimber Kipp is External Affairs Site Liaison at the Gateway Vaccination Site, and she's on the line. Kimber, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to have you back on the show. It's 549-2937 as we talk about the vaccination effort in Jacksonville. Already getting your calls. Send them emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. So, Kimber, as I mentioned, a new poll shows that vaccine hesitancy is a real problem among adults. When vaccines become more widely available for kids, a sizable percentage of parents out there say they're hesitant to give their child the vaccine. So as you deal with this issue, vaccine hesitancy, getting the message out that people need to get vaccinated, tell us what's going on at the FEMA site at the Gateway Town Center, what kind of traffic you're seeing there, and what people need to know.
Well, you bring up very important points. Here at the Gateway site, we are seeing a slowdown of people coming in. Of course, now we are wrapping things up towards the end of the month. We'll be closing on May 25th. We'll be giving our last shots. And right now we're focusing on the second doses of Pfizer vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is also available for those 18 years of age and older. And I guess the important thing that we need people to be aware of is that we have special services here. So if you have questions about the vaccine or side effects or anything like that, we do recommend that you talk with your trusted physician, visit the CDC website at cdc.gov, or you can come in and ask us questions. We have medical staff here that can answer questions. We have pamphlets from the CDC and the FDA, and we're here to put shots in arms, answer questions, and get back to that normal.
Sure. We've said this so many times on the program. In populations where there's widespread vaccination rates, cases of COVID, serious cases involving hospitalizations and deaths, they plummet. The numbers absolutely plummet. It is in everyone's best interest to get vaccinated so that we can save lives and end this pandemic. Now, as you said, Kimber, you're offering the second dose of the Pfizer shot at the FEMA site and also the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. What's your message to people who are hesitant to receive that vaccine? Because there were a tiny handful of people who had adverse reactions to the J&J shot.
Correct. I can only say that educating yourself and finding out what you're comfortable with doing by talking to a physician or talking to somebody else that that you trust will give you that comfort level. The vaccines on a whole is not going to work unless we all do it. So I recommend people coming in, asking questions, talking to their physicians, looking up information on the CDC website.
Yeah, and that information is available at cdc.gov. There's also a lot of misinformation out there. This week, Fox News host Tucker Carlson spread, I think it's fair to say, dangerous disinformation about the safety of the COVID vaccination. And Josh, if you could play that. This is Tucker Carlson this week on Fox News.
Between late December of 2020 and last month, a total of 3,362 people apparently died after getting the COVID vaccine in the United States. It's clear that what is happening now, for whatever reason, is not even close to normal. It's not even close to what we see in previous years with previous vaccines.
Okay, that's not true. First off, that's simply not true. But this kind of misinformation about the safety of the COVID vaccine is causing fewer people to get vaccinated, which endangers everyone, Kimber.
True. Unfortunately, we can't stop all of the misinformation. All we can do is provide guidance to those people who have questions and point them in the right direction of the specialists and the people who know the real authorities on this, which, again, is the CDC, the FDA, and your local trusted physicians.
What is the foot traffic like at the FEMA site?
It's very slow. I was able to speak with the state this morning and get the numbers from yesterday. And our attendance yesterday was only 101 vaccinations provided. So we do have the capacity for up to 3,000 Johnson & Johnson vaccines per day here at the site, and along with the scheduled second doses of Pfizer. So we're not even close to hitting our capacity level here. That's why we're trying to get the message out and urging folks to come in, and ask their questions and feel that comfort level to come in and either speak with us or get the vaccine. Whatever we can do to help, we're here to do.
Sure. The Biden administration has announced it's pivoting away from mass vaccination sites at the end of this month, like the FEMA site at Gateway. They're going to be doing other things like refrigerated vans, community health clinics, even door-to-door campaigns in more rural communities. The national case numbers for COVID have declined over the last 2 weeks. The president wants to get us back to something approaching normal by July 4th. Here's another number for you. Fewer than 1.1 million Americans are receiving a first dose of vaccine each day. That's the lowest average since the end of February. But the slowdown means it will take that much longer to reach a level of protection from the virus that will allow a return for normal life for everyone. So as we talk with the FEMA folks in Jacksonville, what are your questions? Let us know. Have you been vaccinated? Are you hesitant? 549-2937. Eric is in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Morning, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I just, I don't understand why the young lady you're having a conversation with now just said that they're going to close the site at Gateway at the end of May. That's where I got both my vaccinations, and I have to say it was very efficient and went very quickly. I was a little bit sore in my arm that night and had a little bit of flu-like symptoms the next day, but now I'm protected. It was very efficient, and I would recommend to anybody that needs a vaccine to go out there. But here's the thing that really bothers me, is why isn't Governor DeSantis, instead of throwing these hissy fits in all these press conferences where he is chiding people for not going back to work at restaurants and bars, chiding people for working from home, making a point to reward the police and throw in his own misinformation about how trailers of bricks were set up for Black Lives Matter protests across the country so that protesters could throw bricks at cops. Why isn't he having press conferences to say, hey, listen, it's really important that everyone get vaccinated. We're going to close these mass sites at the end of May. And if we have to do all these door-to-door things and these mobile refrigerated trucks, it's going to cost more money. So let's everybody pull together and let's go get vaccinated and be done with this thing. Instead, every day he's having these press conferences, which are blatantly political and hostile and I think petulant. And I just wonder what your take is on that.
Okay, Eric, thank you. I know as a spokesperson at the federal level, Kimber, you're probably quite limited in what you can say about how you've worked with state officials here in Florida. But what about Eric's comment?
Eric, thank you so much for the compliment on our site. You know, we do have a fantastic site here. It's extremely efficient. We've had nothing but good reviews. I cannot speak to the governor's comments. That's for the state to make that comment on that. But what I can do is I can tell you that, you know, we're going through all we can to make sure that the vaccine is available for all those who want it in the underserved communities and around towns. For instance, tomorrow we have a mobile vaccination site that's going to be out at the Deer Meadows Baptist Church from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. And these are the kind of things that we're trying to do here to get to the communities that are not being served by the Gateway Mall.
Mm-hmm.
We're also not the only ones doing it. The state is actually doing this as well, and they have mobile sites going out into the underserved communities. And we are trying to, as a team, as a joint team with the state and with the Department of Defense, trying to get out and reach everybody.
Once the FEMA site closes at the end of May, where will all of you go? Will you go to more of these mobile sites? What's the plan?
That's a good question, and I don't know for sure. We do, as far as the FEMA staff goes, we will have other sites that some of us will be going to somewhere around the country. We also have preparation to do for any of the other disasters that are going to be coming up. Hurricane season is coming up.
Sure.
I myself will probably be going back to working on what I was doing before I got called to do this here.
Here's a question, too, from a listener, Kimber. Will the FEMA folks be vaccinating children age 12 to 15 once that's given the green light?
As far as I've been told, no, this site will not be offering that service.
Thanks for that. And lots of calls as we speak this morning about the vaccination effort at the FEMA site at Jacksonville's Gateway Mall. If you're just tuning in, they're going to close up those tents at the end of the month. Until then, their message is, come on out and be vaccinated. No appointment necessary. We're speaking with Kimber Kipp, the External Affairs Liaison at the Gateway site for FEMA, and the number to join us is 549-2937. Lynn is on the south side. Hi, Lynn. Lynn. Hey, Lynn. Lynn, you're on the air.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just calling to say, you know, you had mentioned a little earlier about, you know, the more vaccinations are in a community, the more effective it is. And I just saw in the news this morning that the city of San Francisco is about 70% vaccinated right now, and they only had 26 new cases. And the city of San Francisco is obviously an enormous metropolitan area that was really suffering. So, you know, just reinforcing, you know, that idea of the more people are vaccinated, the less COVID cases we have, and obviously the less death and suffering. And also thank the the sites that are open and running in Jacksonville for the work that they've been doing. Our whole family's been vaccinated, from my husband and I all the way down to our four children, the youngest being 17, and it's just wonderful that we've had such accessibility and ease, and, you know, the work that everyone's doing is really appreciated by so many of us that live here in this community.
Oh, Lynn, that's great. Kimber, what about that? There is data to show that fully vaccinated adults are 94% less likely to be hospitalized with COVID-19 than their peers. That's adults 65 or older, and the numbers track closely with younger adults. This is just something we can't say enough times. Fully vaccinated adults are incredibly less likely to get sick or die from COVID-19. It's as simple as that.
Correct. That's exactly what the CDC and all of the physicians through the FDA are saying.
Stacy in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Stacy.
Hey there. Love this show. Always great.
Thank you so much.
As well as the guests. Wanted to know, I have my sister will be visiting from out of town, and it's from a state where there's a lot of restrictions. Is she able to come and get the Johnson & Johnson single shot?
Thank you for that, Stacy. It's a walk-up opportunity, Kimber. Can anyone come, whether or not they're a Florida resident?
We are open to anyone who comes in. There's no appointments necessary. We are asking that it is just 18 years of age and older for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And if you are here to provide a service or to serve goods or anything like that, you are more than welcome to come in. At this point in time, we are not asking for any additional documentation.
Okay, thank you for that. Bill in Atlantic Beach. Hello, Bill. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to express my strong feeling that the media and the federal FEMA people should be more condemning of the misinformation that Tucker Carlson put out, because it's very misleading, and I think people should be jumping up and down at the falsehood and identifying the truth of the matter, or doesn't matter the truth of the matter, just condemning this Carlson stuff with vigor.
Thank you, Bill. We did reference that at the top of the hour. I don't know if you heard that.
Great. Yeah, I did. And it was very mild in my view, so I think I should be punched up a bit more.
On Wednesday evening, Fox News host Tucker Carlson tried to mainstream vaccine skepticism. He speculated that thousands of Americans have died from COVID-19 vaccinations. That's not true. He cited a faulty open source database that's become a haven for misinformation. Over the past few months, Carlson has repeatedly used his top-rated primetime show to cast doubt on both the efficacy and the safety of the coronavirus vaccines. This is simply reckless, and it is it's making it more difficult for the entire nation to reach herd immunity. Now, that said, we're getting emails and tweets for you, Kimber, about this. They say, here's one from a listener. He says, some believe that this vaccine was issued too fast, and we want to wait to get more data on possible negative effects. I know people in the medical profession in that category. I did get vaccinated, so did my wife, and we are fine. What's your message, Kimber, to those who are hesitant because they want to see long-term studies on the safety of the vaccines?
Yeah, I respect their decision. We're not forcing this on anybody. We are here to support those who want to be vaccinated. We're supporting the state in their efforts to get everyone vaccinated who wants a vaccine. Again, we're not pushing this on anybody. We're not forcing anybody to mm-hmm. get the vaccine. We want everybody to be comfortable with their decision.
One more
I myself have...
You yourself have been vaccinated.
I have. Very little side effects, and I did take the two-dose Pfizer.
I got the two-dose Moderna. Let's take one more call. Jimmy on Fleming Island. Go ahead, Jimmy.
A lot of friends of mine have had COVID-19, and they say, well, we got immunity to COVID-19. Why get a shot? It's ridiculous to get it. So basically, if you take all the people that have COVID-19, add it to the shots, you've got herd immunity.
Jimmy, thanks for that. Kimber, what about Jimmy's argument?
That's something for the CDC to address. I don't have that information or knowledge.
Okay. Should you get vaccinated, I'll Google this, if you've already had COVID-19. let me check. Let's see what the CDC says. They recommend that you get vaccinated anyway. Even if you've had the virus. And Jimmy, I know that's probably not going to convince you. Here is a message from the Cleveland Clinic. They also recommend getting vaccinated if you've had COVID-19, because a small number of people can get it a second time. And she says it's important to build up your immune system in case you become susceptible again. They don't know how long your immunity will last after you've had a natural COVID-19 infection, is what infectious disease experts are saying. So I hope that answers your question, Jimmy. And I want to thank you so much, Kimber Kipp at the FEMA site at Gateway. They are open through the end of the month. Go get your vaccine there or wherever is convenient. Kimber, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
And later in the hour, a tour of Riverside Avondale's glorious gardens is coming up this weekend. How you can be part of it. But up next.
Mexicans constitute the largest group of immigrants to the United States traditionally.
First Coast immigration expert and former State Department official John Caulfield on what's really going on at the border. We'll be right back. Welcome back. In recent weeks, we've been hearing about a new influx of immigrants at the southern border. I spoke about it with Jacksonville resident and retired State Department official John Caulfield. Now, Caulfield oversaw large-scale immigration efforts in his career at State from both Latin America and Asia, and he has important insights about what's happening. Take a listen. Hi, John. Good to have you back on the program. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks very much, Melissa. Glad to be here.
And as we talk about the situation at the border and immigration issues, we do need to explain your expertise because during your career with the State Department, you were heavily involved in processing legal immigrants into the U.S., across the U.S.-Mexico border, and then also a large processing effort of Asian immigrants into the U.S. But right. Two different parts of the world. Can you first talk a little bit about your expertise?
Yeah, well, when you join the Foreign Service, it's a little like joining the Army. You have a specialty in arms. In the case of the Army, it's infantry, artillery, or cavalry. But in the Foreign Service, you pick an area. It could be consular, such as I picked, which is visas and services to Americans abroad. And then there's political, economic, and administration and public affairs. And so throughout the beginning of your career, you tend to specialize more. And I did this by being a vice consul, issuing non-immigrant visas, later issuing immigrant visas, and as I rose through the ranks, supervising larger operations. Of course, at the end of your career, if you're successful, you have much broader responsibilities. And as you know, I ended up as chief of our mission in Havana at the end of my career. Mm-hmm. But before that, I processed hundreds of thousands of visas.
Right. And in Mexico, you directed one of the largest processing centers of legal immigrants into the U.S., actually the largest, Ciudad Juarez, opposite El Paso, Texas. Yeah?
Right. And Mexicans constitute the largest group of immigrants to the United States traditionally. And all of our immigrant processing for Mexico was at our consulate in Ciudad Juarez. So I was head of that immigration center. It was the modern-day Ellis Island because of the large number of immigrants that went through there.
Okay, so that sets the table then for us to talk to you about what's going on at the border. A large number of migrants did cross the border from Mexico in April. That said, recently President Biden told reporters that the situation at the border is under control. How would you assess the current situation at the border?
Well, I mean, if you go back several decades, we see that there have been periods of dramatic increases in particularly Central American immigration. We've always had a flow of Mexicans across the border for seasonal work, for agricultural work, construction work, although it's gotten more complicated in recent years. But since the 1980s, we have seen flows of Central Americans for various reasons. And at different times, two factors affect this flow. One is what U.S. policy is on admission of Central Americans. And most of these people are not eligible to qualify for normal visas. So what is our policy in letting people in? And secondly, what is the job market in the U.S.? Because what is the real draw for immigrants to the U.S. is the economic opportunity of jobs.
Sure. And we've known that for so long. So I know that you feel that there are a lot of misconceptions about immigration and the problems that have become such a polarizing political issue. What are the biggest misconceptions about how this is all handled?
I think there is a confusion between who is a refugee and who is seeking asylum. And it's actually the same law applies, but refugees are people who have been dislocated from their home countries, but are overseas, but are outside the United States. And they could be in the Middle East, they could be in Southeast Asia, Vietnamese, who after the Vietnam War fled. It could be in Africa as tribal or religious warfare causes refugee migrants. And there is a process under U.S. law and international convention to identify refugees, and then under U.S. law, we may admit a certain number that is determined every year by the president with consultation of the Congress. And traditionally, these have been about 100,000 a year. In recent years, no, because the policies of the Trump administration, and especially because of COVID, which basically shut down migrant processing around the world, both legal and refugee. So those are refugees. Not all people who are refugees get to come to the United States or get resettled in other countries, but there is a process to determine who are the most deserving cases, and then who is most likely to adapt well towards resettlement in the United States. Now, the other case, as I mentioned, is asylum seekers. And those are people who are in the United States when something changes back home. There's a revolution, like Iranian students who were in the United States at the time of the Iranian Revolution. Many of those who didn't want to go back requested asylum in the United States. After Tiananmen Square, many Chinese students in the United States, or, you know, for various reasons, people in the U.S. who, when things dramatically change at home, feel that it's unsafe to go back, they can apply for asylum. Now, traditionally, the number of people applying for asylum in the U.S. was not large. It was fewer than the number of people applying for refugee processing abroad. But at various points, starting particularly in the 1990s, and then continuing up to date, we had people from around the world, but mostly Central America, mostly relatively close areas, Cuba, Haiti, Central America, coming to the U.S. border or getting in boats to get to the U.S. coast in order to remain here and say they were fleeing, you know, conditions in their country that would justify refugee status. Sometimes in the past, they never bothered to claim any status. They were just trying to get to the U.S. And to survive here, to find jobs, to start a new life. And they weren't particularly worried about their status. And it was easier in the past to live in the United States without any documentation to get jobs than it is today. But today, we've seen in the recent years the phenomena of people actually walking up to the U.S. border and claiming asylum. And as people perceive that this could be a successful way of entering the United States, of course it was a stimulus to others who were facing similar difficult conditions in their home countries to also make their way to the U.S. border and seek admission. And so by 2019, we were having over 100,000 migrants a month coming up to the U.S. border. Now, the U.S. has tried different ways to deal with this. I mean, traditionally, if you were undocumented, you arrived at the border, you were turned back. And if you were caught, you know, coming by a boat, you were interdicted and you were returned to your home country. But advocates and many of the migrants themselves, when they arrived in recent years, began to say, well, actually, I'm entitled to make a claim for asylum status because I have suffered from prejudice or from discrimination based on certain categories within U.S. law, such as discrimination or harassment on based on their race, their religion, their national origin or ethnic group, their political activities, or their membership in certain social groups, such as a labor union, for example. And the vast numbers of people arriving simultaneously overwhelmed the U.S. system to make decisions in these cases. And the U.S. also decided that it was not going to do refugee processing in the Central American countries, or for that matter in Mexico, which was the interim destination. So this left the entire load of people arriving at the border. And of course, their cases could not be decided initially. And this led to, ultimately, the decision by the U.S. government under the previous administration and by the courts mandated this, that people simply had to be released until their cases could be adjudicated.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no short-term prospect. And over a million people entered in late 2018 through 2019 in this situation. The change happened with COVID. When the COVID infection started, the Trump administration used different law, public health laws, to basically ban the entry of people who were considered to be a public health risk. And this decision essentially shut off the flow because back home, people realized that, hey, I'm not going to be admitted. I'm going to be stuck, you know, somewhere along the route. I might as well stay where I am in Central America. Now, with the change in administration, there was the perception in Central America, oh, well, maybe this administration will be more sympathetic. And there was reason for that because they heard, you know, what the statements were during the campaign.
Yeah.
So groups tested it out.
They're testing it out. Let me ask you about that. Lots of unaccompanied minors are being sent across the border. The Biden administration is telling people not to send their children. At the same time, the Biden administration said this week that four families that were separated at the border during the Trump presidency will be reunited and that they are working to reunite more families. Thousands were separated from their parents during the Trump years. That was highly controversial. We've gotten emails about that from listeners saying if they're going to reunite the families, will that send the signal that more people will try to send their children across the border illegally? What are your thoughts about how the Biden administration is handling this and how it differs from what the Trump administration did?
Well, the first challenge that the Biden administration faced was all of a sudden there were more people, you know, coming, trying out. And the Biden administration turned people away. I mean, they refused to admit these people. They returned them to Mexico. And if there were families, they returned the whole family. But then families started sending their kids over, or relatives started sending kids north to join parents that were already in the United States who had come in the previous wave. And so confronted with minors without parents, without relatives, unaccompanied minors, as a humanitarian gesture, the administration said, well, okay, we will admit these people and try to sort out what their case is. It's too dangerous just to send a child alone back to northern Mexico. Well, and I appreciate the humanitarian gesture, and but also this was a signal to people that if you can't get your kids to the U.S. legally, then if you send them to the border, they will be admitted, and there's the hope that they'll be reunited with their relatives living in the United States. So we saw a big increase in unaccompanied minors as a result. Now, the vast majority of these children are coming to join people, parents, already in the United States, parents or other close relatives. And very often, people who entered just a year or so or 2 years ago in the previous wave. Then the administration was faced by the fact that Mexico said, hey, we're not taking back families with large numbers of children if we do not have facilities in Mexico to take care of them. So at many spots along the border, families with children were stuck in the U.S. because Mexico wouldn't take them back.
That was State Department official, retired State Department official, Jacksonville's John Caulfield. Okay, it's International Compost Awareness Week. Tiffany Bess, who owns Apple Rabbit Compost, is on the line to tell us how we can all get into composting. Hey, Tiffany, good morning.
Hey, hello, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great to have you. So let's talk about International Compost Awareness Week. Let's explain what composting is for people who don't know what you do.
Yeah, of course. So composting is a biological chemical process. It transforms organic, as in once living materials, like leaves or food scraps, into a miracle soil amendment called compost, or black gold.
Yeah.
This process is kind of like following a recipe. It has four ingredients: carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, water. You act as the sous chef, assisting the true chef of the compost pile, the microorganisms. And your role is to just kind of make sure there's a proper balance of those four ingredients so that those microorganisms are able to do their job of breaking down that organic material.
Right. Now, a lot of people compost at home. They do it themselves. But what you do is take the work out of it for people. Tell us about Apple Rabbit.
Yeah, so Apple Rabbit makes it easy for people who want to compost but don't want to do the work themselves. They don't have the time. They don't have the space. They just don't have the desire to do it themselves. So we provide a couple subscription services. We can pick up from your house if you live in the 32202 through 07 area codes. We provide you with a bucket. It's lined with a compostable liner. You fill it up with your food scraps, and then we come by once a week, empty it out, give it a little wipe down, make sure it's nice and clean for you, and then rinse and repeat. And then we also have a drop-off subscription at the Riverside Arts Market for people that don't live in our subscription area, or, you know, just want to have a cheaper option, a cheaper subscription. So we have that available for them as well. And same sort of thing. You have liners available, and then you come and dump your bucket. And yeah.
So you create compost, which you then at Apple Rabbit distribute. And every so often you get some compost for your own garden through your service. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes, ma'am. Every 6 months you can opt to have your share of compost back. And if you don't want your share back, we donate it to like nonprofits, community gardens, local organizations that could use a little bit of black gold in their gardens.
This not only does this help gardens, does wonders for gardens, it reduces food waste too.
Oh, yes. Very important. Food waste in landfills does not decompose. Like, it does in a compost pile. Landfills are anaerobic, meaning they do not have oxygen. So its process of decomposition is very different. It releases a lot of greenhouse gases, like methane, into our atmosphere, which increases the Earth's temperature. It leads to higher, you know, rates of fires and, you know, flooding and disease and, you know, just all sorts of bad things come from having excess greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. And food waste is a huge contributor to that, but composting is a great solution.
Yeah, it really is. So if you've kind of toyed with this idea, but you really don't want to take it on yourself, Apple Rabbit is here to provide the solution. Now, you can go to applerabbit.org and sign up for their subscription service. Very affordable. Or you can check them out at Riverside Arts Market under the bridge every Saturday. And where else can people learn more about composting, Tiffany, as we talk about Compost Awareness Week?
Well, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is a great organization. They are very big on community composting, which is the level that I do it at, and they're able to teach a lot about at-home composting as well. So the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is a huge resource for composters. The U.S. Composting Council is great, too. And then locally, we have our Duval Soil Water Conservation District, which I'm an affiliate member of. And then we have the U.S. ICIS Extension Office, and they do a lot of like composting workshops as well.
Fantastic. Again, go to applerabbit.org and take advantage of this amazing composting service. Creator and owner Tiffany Bess here with us to explain all about it. Applerabbit.org to start composting yourself. Tiffany, thank you. Well, you won't really do it yourself. She'll do it for you, but you get the benefits. Tiffany, thank you so much, and great to see your success with this.
Thank you so much, and happy International Compost Awareness Week.
And in a moment, how you, speaking of gardens and how they benefit from composting, how you can take advantage of this weekend's glorious tour of backyard gardens in Riverside, Avondale. You don't want to miss this. We'll tell you all about it after this. Don't go away.
CNS Healthcare is offering an agitation associated with Alzheimer's dementia research study. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they shown verbal or physical symptoms of agitation? Learn more at 904-281-5757. Congareen Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareenpen.com.
Love British drama? Now get unlimited access to thousands of the very best award-winning British dramas, including a British true crime collection featuring hits A Confession, Honor, and even more chilling crime. Plus, get access to your favorite PBS programs like Flesh and Blood and The Long Song through Jack's PBS Passport Plus. Available from any device, go to jacksbundle.com and activate today.
On the next Fresh Air, how a promised land to generations of black families became a community of lost lives. We talk with Linda Villarosa about her New York Times Magazine article titled, Black Lives Are Shorter in Chicago. My Family History Shows Why. She covers the intersection of health and medicine and social justice. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
America's new attorney general says he needs more resources to fight domestic terrorism, and it's a battle he's not fighting alone. Medieval historians are also on the front lines. They're pushing back against neo-Nazis who've hijacked their field to paint a world that's at best a total fantasy. Myths, White Men, and the Middle Ages. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, for the first time in many years, residents of Riverside Avondale are opening up their gardens to showcase the glorious beauty of these spaces. It's all happening during this Saturday's Riverside Avondale Garden Tour. Now, there will be both small and large gardens on the tour, and you'll be able to check out a wide variety of outdoor spaces in the historic neighborhood. We're pleased to welcome Warren Jones, Executive Director at Riverside Avondale Preservation, and Hazel Clary, Chairperson of the Garden Tour Committee, and her garden's on the tour. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Okay, let's begin with you, Warren. 12 residential homes, 5 businesses, and 3 community parks are part of this garden tour. This is something that hasn't happened in a long time in this neighborhood. What brought it back?
It has been a while, and thank you for having us on, by the way, Melissa. So last year, we had many, many events planned. It was the 150th anniversary of the founding of Riverside and the 100th anniversary of the founding of Avondale. And so we asked volunteers from the community to come together and help plan a variety of different events, and Hazel and her team wanted to bring back the garden tour, and we're so fortunate that they did. It's going to be very interesting and very useful for people. We have so many parks. We have 26 parks in our historic district, 75 acres, but the community has come together to really showcase the gardens that are in their homes.
Now, one of those homes is yours, Hazel. Your garden is on the tour. So people can also, by the way, I'm going to be doing this with some friends. I'm going to be checking out the tour via GoTuckin, riding on a GoTuckin bus. So I don't have to walk the whole way. But tell us about your garden and what else people can enjoy.
Well, my garden is named Patio My Back. And we built a patio in a horrible garden. It was just terrible when we bought it. And we've revived it. Paving stones are down, and we have lots of plants. I think it'll be pretty interesting for people to see what you can do when your garden doesn't have a lot of hope. And all the gardens have really cute names. We've got a karma, time to grow up, all kinds of different names for the gardens. So we just hope that people get a lot of information, can figure out what to do with their own yards, and see what other people have done and how people can be so innovative.
That's the thing. You can really get innovative with these spaces, Warren. And people, when they come out to the tour, they will get to check in with gardening experts so that they can recreate these spaces at home, right?
That's correct. There will be gardening experts. There will also be artists from the Artist Guild that will be doing live painting of some of the gardens. We'll have musicians in some of the gardens. It's going to be a very entertaining garden tour. And also people will be able to come away with many, many ideas. For instance, one of our homes has raised garden plots, and they got that idea from our community garden, which is on Park Street, which also has raised garden plots. So we're hoping people will take some of the ideas that they see and bring them to their own homes.
Okay, so with all of that said, you can get your tickets now for the garden tour at the WRAP office at 2623 Herschel Street. You don't even have to get out of your car to get your tickets and your garden map there. You can get tickets at the Riverside Arts Market this Saturday. Is that right? You can get them there too?
That's correct.
Okay. And when you come out to the garden tour, you can ride on the Gotuckin bus, which I'm going to be doing with some friends. I'm excited about that. It'll be my first time on the Gotuckin. You can rent bikes from ZenCog on Stockton Street. You can rent bikes from Art Bikes Jacks. That's a new service. There's going to be a lot of fun scheduled with this. So check it out.
By the way, Memorial Park will also have special tours at 10, 11, and 4. So people can go by there also with their tickets.
And that's to learn about the park itself. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Terrific. Well, it's going to be a beautiful weekend in Riverside, Avondale. Yes. Check out the Riverside Avondale Garden Tour. It's coming up this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5. And thank you so much, Warren Jones, Executive Director at Riverside Avondale Preservation. Hazel Clary, Chairperson of the Committee on this, and her garden is one of the ones that you'll be able to enjoy. Have fun, and I'll see you guys out there.
We're looking forward to it. Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Keep that feedback coming. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, just catch our podcast. It's up later today on all platforms. You can also listen to it through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. See you then, and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.